A check of small businesses as we go backwards with this virus. It's entirely possible this economy is going to come down to cardboard boxes. Also, our guess as to the economic buzzword of the next couple of months. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Monday today, the 16th day of November. Good, as always, to have you along, everybody. A couple of things right off the bat. Some of the headline news of the day as we see it. And then, as usual, the context of what is going on in this economy. Item one, of course, the vaccine news from Moderna. The second 90-plus percent efficiency rate vaccine in 1 week. The stock market, as we know, is not the, how do we know that? Because I hear it on the radio all the time. We know it's not the economy, but it can give a real-time indicator of feelings about the future of this economy. Overall, today, feeling pretty good, eventually. Item two, President-elect Biden. He had a meeting today with some corporate CEOs and union leaders, Mary Barra at GM, Satya Nadella at Microsoft, to name a couple. He made some remarks afterward. The president-elect did said he supports a $3 trillion relief package. He wants money to support state and local budgets in there as well. And he said labor unions are going to have more power while he is in office. Item three, California, and here is where things turn more sober. This afternoon, Governor Gavin Newsom rolled back a whole slew of business reopenings here in what is, I think, like the fifth largest economy in the world, if it were a country, maybe seventh largest, I forget, but you get my point. Anyway, he did that, as is happening in virtually the whole country, the virus raging out of control. There are echoes in this of what happened back in the spring when small businesses in particular got clobbered. So Marketplace's Erica Barris spent her day on the phone with some of those small businesses.
When things shut down in the spring, the Stampede Cocktail Club in Seattle, Washington, got a PPP loan, held a GoFundMe to help support employees, scale back days and hours, sold gift cards and merchandise and to-go drinks.
I always joke around that we've pivoted so much that our hips hurt.
That's General Manager Sarah Grindstaff. She says business revenue is down by 75%. And with this new shutdown looming,
I think it's going to be completely different. I think it's a different ballgame. I think people, you know, we didn't know what we were going into this first time, so it was kind of like, oh, a pandemic. But now it's like, this is a pandemic.
And more than half a year later, many people have been struggling for months, says Matthew Slaughter, an economist at Dartmouth College.
Unfortunately, more of their customers and clients are more stressed financially because of the absence of some of the federal government support that have rolled off.
That worries Wendelin Scott, who owns Yoga Source in Santa Fe, New Mexico. When things shut down the first time, she had two locations.
It was pretty stressful. The psychological and emotional stress that everybody was under, and then the intense learning curve to get everybody online.
Then in June, she shut down one of her studios. Now most of her classes are online, but she's just breaking even. She hopes her remaining brick-and-mortar studio will survive the winter. In Chicago, Candace Cowles, who owns Hair Salon Come See See Me, where she makes custom wigs and weaves for her clients, hopes she's prepared. Before the pandemic, clients would bring her hair bundles and she'd style them in shop. Now Kyle's buys the hair, styles it, sends it to customers, and then virtually walks them through how to do it themselves.
We don't even have to touch each other, see each other, or anything. So now the profits are higher.
Kyle's is optimistic, but her business depends on clients with disposable income and how they weather the COVID-19 winter. I'm Erica Barris for Marketplace.
We talked on Friday, if you remember, about the holiday shopping season and how retailers are outfitting their warehouses to get ready for a pandemic-induced surge in online sales. There's a whole bunch of logistics they have to worry about and staffing and IT stuff. Also, though, some simpler things, as Marketplace's Mariel Segarra reports.
In a pandemic, retailers kind of have to take the sales they can get. But this whole shift to online shopping over the holidays is going to cost them, because they have to spend money on things like cardboard boxes.
If it's a very small box, it could be in the cents. If it's a very large box, it can be dollars.
Brian Smith is an executive at Georgia Pacific. It makes corrugated cardboard boxes. He says box orders for online retail are up by more than 30% compared to last year.
It's certainly been a challenge because we're taking extraordinary steps to keep all of our employees safe, which can slow production down considerably. So sometimes it involves running extra hours and into weekends to keep up with demand.
Also, the company's paper mills are running at full capacity, and Georgia-Pacific has been buying paper from small suppliers when it can't make enough. On recent earnings calls, other cardboard box makers have also said demand is off the charts. David Marcotte, a Kantar, says we're not seeing a shortage of cardboard boxes in the U.S. at this point. But with COVID-related shipping delays, it might be tough to get all the boxes to retailers when they need them.
The boxes have to be shipped from the manufacturer to whoever's going to be using them, be it Amazon, Target, Walmart, etc.
One scenario, if a worker at a warehouse doesn't have the right sized box, they could use the wrong size. You ever order a bottle of hand soap online and it shows up rolling around in a box that could fit a pair of knee-high boots?
When things are getting pressed and things are going quickly and they can't grab the box that's really suited for a box of soap, they'll grab whatever box because I got to keep the line moving.
Which costs a little more and doesn't always go over so well with customers who see it as wasteful. I'm Mariel Segarra for Marketplace.
This was one of those days on Wall Street where you knew right from the jump that the algorithms were going to go wild. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The number one app yesterday for both Android and iPhone users was the social media platform Parler. It is geared distinctly to conservatives, right-wing conservatives, we should say, who say they do, without grounding in any kind of fact, that Twitter and Facebook are censoring them. Well, we learned over the weekend in the pages of the Wall Street Journal that Parler is supported by one wealthy benefactor, Republican megadonor Rebecca Mercer, who has also bankrolled GOP political action committees and think tanks. But in the oh-so-crowded world of social media, is one deep-pocketed investor enough? Marketplace's Scott Tong looked into Parler's business model.
The Parler app right now has hit postings on fake news, errant voting machines, and a coup against President Trump. In the past week, its users rocketed to 8 million. And Libby Hemphill at the University of Michigan School of Information says having money from GOP donor Rebecca Mercer can insulate Parler from critics in the media market.
They don't have to be as responsive necessarily if they have somebody who's willing to pay for them to weather challenges from advertisers or critiques from the media or critiques from users.
In addition to Mercer's money, Parler plans to earn revenue by having social media stars market products. Here's founder John Mates in a July TV interview.
People can advertise with influencers specifically and those influencers' brands rather than our brand as a company as a whole.
This is different from, say, Twitter or Facebook, where companies run ads on your feed. On Parler, brands pay the influencers to do the talking, says Max Reimer at the digital marketing firm Native.
You're basically paying this platform to link you up with someone else who will make it look almost organic that they're parlaying or that they're promoting your product.
He says this concept is in the early beta stage at Parler. Brian Weiser at Group M, a media investment firm, says for influencers, joining an ideological site like Parler could turn off some fans.
You are associating yourself with what it stands for. That may not be desirable for a lot of influencers, if not the majority of influencers.
Going forward, Hemphill at Michigan is watching for whether Parler users organize big events or host unique conversations. If not, she thinks users may go back to the social media sites they came from. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
One of the first phone calls that President-elect Biden made after it became clear he was the president-elect was to British Prime Minister Boris Johnson. It was a bit of a surprise, that call was. Biden and Johnson don't have the closest of relationships. Mr. Biden has called Mr. Johnson, and this is a quote, a physical and emotional clone of Donald Trump. Still, you negotiate with the partner you have, not the partner you want. So in economic terms, trade specifically, what might that conversation mean? With Britain now out of the EU and the deadline for a trade agreement with Europe drawing ever closer for Mr. Johnson, is there hope for a deal with the United States? From London, Marketplace's Stephen Beard has that one.
Joe Biden's phone conversation with Johnson was greeted with glee by Brexit supporters. The Daily Telegraph newspaper hailed it a major diplomatic coup. The Daily Express said it would boost the chances of a US-UK trade deal. But some trade experts here don't take such a rosy view of the prospects for a transatlantic deal with Trump out of the White House.
I think it's quite a lot less likely.
Professor Alan Winters of the UK Trade Policy Observatory.
Trump was very keen, as was the UK government, to reach an agreement. And so I think they would have tried very hard for the sake of having a political triumph.
Ever hostile to the EU, Trump was keen to support the breakaway country. But the president-elect's priorities will be the polar opposite, says Alison Stewart Allen, author of a new book, Working with Americans.
I think it's very likely that a US-EU free trade agreement will precede a US-UK agreement.
Biden, she says, wants to repair what he sees as the damage done to US-EU relations over the past 4 years. And economically, it makes far more sense to pursue a deal with the 27-nation bloc before one with Britain.
The size of the prize for American business to trade with the EU is significantly larger.
For Joe Biden, there's the added dimension of his Irish ancestry. He and many other Democrats condemned the UK's plan to tear up part of its EU withdrawal agreement, the bit that seeks to avoid a hard border between the British province of Northern Ireland and the Irish Republic. Biden fears that would undermine the Good Friday Agreement that brought peace to Northern Ireland more than 20 years ago. Kim Darroch, a former British ambassador to the US, told the BBC,
especially if we also try to unilaterally to rewrite withdrawal agreement, then I think there is honestly no chance of a UK-US free trade deal.
Brexiteers are furious. John Longworth, head of the Independent Business Network.
The withdrawal agreement really is null and void because the EU have acted in bad faith. And actually, I think Biden is completely misunderstanding this.
Longworth claims the EU has shown its bad faith by, among other things, demanding regulatory control over Britain after Brexit. But forget the politics, he says. Just look at the economics of the transatlantic relationship.
There ought to be a free trade arrangement between the UK and the USA. We are already big mutual investors. We're already big trade partners.
Exports and imports of goods between the two nations are worth $130 billion a year, but that's merely 20% of America's trade with the EU. And bottom line, Biden may have too much on his plate in the short term to think about a trade deal with Britain. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Tomorrow morning, bright and early, all you need to know to start your economic day, the Marketplace Morning Report. Check it out. Coming up.
Just got over doing the election, counting of the ballot. So I've been really, really busy.
Yeah, that'd do it. But first, let's us do the numbers. Really? I totally thought it was going to be the super happy music today. I don't get the pick. Anyway, Dow Industrial's up 470, 1.6%, 29,950. The NASDAQ up 94 points, 0.8%. Ended at 11,924. The S&P 500 up 41 points, 0.1%, 36.26 there. Moderna shares up 9.5% on news of its vaccine. Pfizer, which said a week ago its own vaccine was more than 90% effective, dropped 3.3% today. Stocks that would benefit from the economy reopening, they moved higher. American Airlines up 4.4% today. United jumped 5.1%. Cinemark Holdings chalked a gain of 4.5%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. If you listen real close over the next couple of months, as President-elect Biden gets set to take office, and afterward in particular, you're going to start hearing one word showing up in a lot of stories about this economy.
So austerity it's an old word. We get it from Greek.
Austerity is the word. Jessica Rett is professor of linguistics at UCLA.
It started out meaning bitter, harsh, rough, and that came to mean over the centuries, effectively severe self-discipline, simplicity, just an absence of fun stuff.
The reason you're hearing about it on this program, though,
there's a particular point at which the metaphor was extended to talk about budgets.
Exactly.
John Maynard Keynes, in an article in 1937, he says, "The boom, not the slump, is the right time for austerity at the Treasury."
And thus, a shorthand was born.
Austerity now, when we think about it in the policy sense, we think of it as reducing the budget deficit. That's the goal.
That's Laura Merling. She's an economist at the International Trade Union Confederation, where she studies the impact of austerity policies. The budget deficit in the year just ended, by the way, and remember, deficits are what we overspend in a single year, was $3.1 trillion, mostly because of coronavirus relief spending. You want to cut the deficit, get some austerity policies in place, you got to do some things.
A combination usually of spending cuts and maybe tax increases.
But usually it means government spending less with the goal of bringing down the government debt.
That second voice was J.W. Mason. He's a macroeconomist who teaches at John Jay College at the City University of New York. When you think of the word austerity in a budgetary sense in times like these, what do you think of?
Well, I think of the last decade, Kai.
And that third voice was Heather Boucher. She's president and CEO of the Washington Center for Equitable Growth. And the three of them together are going to help us understand why that word keeps coming up and why it matters.
What we saw after the Great Recession was the longest recovery in U.S. recorded history. And yet,
the recovery was very slow for most people. So we also see this increase in income inequality.
And I think it's pretty widely understood that that was in part because our federal stimulus was much too small and was taken away too soon.
Thank you. Thank you.
February 17th, 2009. President Obama had been in office less than a month.
The American Recovery and Reinvestment Act that I will sign today is the most sweeping economic recovery package in our history.
Initially, right after the crisis, there was this big stimulus.
Laura Merling, again, from the International Trade Union Confederation.
And, you know, all the banks were bailed out and some companies were bailed out. And then about 2 years later, around 2010, there was this push to now all of a sudden worry about the deficit and cut spending.
Yes, those bailouts were eventually paid back with interest. But remember what was going on right then. The Obama administration was trying to get the Affordable Care Act through Congress, and midterm elections were just around the corner.
He gets into the idea that, you know, the deficit is something that we should worry about, supposedly to, you know, win Republican support.
The 2010 midterm elections come and go. Democrats lose 6 seats in the Senate, 63 seats in the House, to Republicans who ran on the idea that government was too big and spending was too high. So a couple of months later, at the 2011 State of the Union,
every day families sacrifice to live within their means. They deserve a government that does the same.
Congressman Paul Ryan, not yet Speaker of the House, but then the chairman of the House Budget Committee, gave the Republican response.
Endless borrowing is not a strategy. Spending cuts have to come first.
And they did. Cuts to spending on education, the Defense Department, community action programs, and state and local governments still recovering from the recession.
And that, it's widely understood now, really deepened the recession and made the recovery much slower than it otherwise would have been.
So when you say austerity, I think of how much lower family incomes were prior to the pandemic than they needed to be.
But look, if I'm a citizen of this economy trying to get by in difficult times and I don't have as much money coming in as I used to and I have to tighten my belt, why should the federal government not have to do the same thing?
Because it doesn't. The way that the federal government works is not the same way that a family budget works. The federal government can borrow. And right now, interest rates are at historic lows, and they have been for quite some time. And that means that the cost of paying back any borrowing we do today will be much lower because of these low interest rates. And we can put that money to good use, getting people back to work.
J.W. Mason from John Jay College has a real good analogy here.
economic downturns are a situation when it's a little bit like having to turn into a skid. You know, if your car is skidding, your first instinct is to pull the wheel the other way, and then you just lose traction and fly off the road. What you have to do is turn in the direction you're skidding to get back control, and then you can then get around in the direction you want to go.
So if the economy loses 22 million jobs in a couple of months, like it did this spring,
our instincts say if taxes are falling, if the economy is slowing, we should tighten our belts. We should do more with less. We should figure out how to cut back to the essentials. But that, when you're the government, you have to be willing to actually do something that seems a little crazy, just like turning into a skid, which is when your tax revenue is falling, you need to pick up the spending.
Which is what Fed Chair Jay Powell has been saying this whole time.
This is the time to use the great fiscal power of the United States to do what we can to support the economy and try to get through this with as little damage to the longer-run productive capacity of the economy as possible.
Why does austerity keep coming up? I mean, it's cyclical, practically.
It's an interesting question. I think that it is cyclical politically more than anything else. There's a lot of politicians who talk about austerity when the other party is in power.
And they see a situation where tax revenues are falling and where there's a sort of economic crisis as an opportunity to push that agenda that they supported anyway.
Yes, Congress and the White House did spend more than $2 trillion to keep this economy functioning when they passed the CARES Act back in March. Since then, though, not a dime, due entirely to Senate Republicans, hence 7 minutes on the radio today about austerity. And as if to make the point of this story, Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell has been firm that what is needed now isn't the $1.8 to $2 trillion that House Democrats and the White House have agreed to, but something closer to $500 billion. Thanks again to J.W. Mason at John Jay College, Heather Boucher at the Washington Center for Equitable Growth, and Laura Merling at the International Trade Union Confederation. Counting ballots is a job. It's a big job that takes hundreds of thousands of people, most of them part-time and temporary, all over the country. Gail Harrell is one of the 10 people we've been following in our series about the American labor force that's called the United States of Work, and she has been doing that in Virginia. In her off hours from her part-time job at a convenience store called Royal Farms, she's been counting the ballots. Virginia is set to certify its election results today, so here is an update from Gail.
Right now, you want the truth. I'm a little bit tired, but everything is fine. It's a rainy day here in Ashburn, and I think that doesn't help either. But I am fine. Just got over doing the election, the counting of the ballots. So I've been really, really busy. So I've been basically working 3 days a week for the election board and the other two at Royal Farms. This year was different for me because I didn't actually want to work the polls with the physical in front of the people this year. So this was kind of like behind the scenes for me. So it was about 20, 25 people working. The schedule was supposed to be 9 to 5, but it just depended on the amount of mail that came in. I think it was a lot of mail-in ballots. It was a lot of mail-in ballots. And you had to count them, keep record of everything, and then we had to verify. You have to verify name, address, signature. Like I say, you didn't have to face the public per se. And I enjoyed it. Nice group of people working with. So it wasn't. I don't have any complaints. Life's too short.
Life is too short. That was Gail Harrell in Ashburn, Virginia, one of the 10 people we are following in our series, The United States of Work. This final note on the way out today, either good news or meh, depending on how you feel about your family and Zoom. The company is going to lift the 40-minute limit on meetings for its free accounts on Thanksgiving Day. So all the turkey and trimmings you want and grandma on the laptop, which is, to be completely clear, where she ought to be this year. You got to stay safe out there. All right, we got to go, but here is your Monday moment of economic context on the way out. It's also your occasional reminder that big-time college sports is, in fact, a business. Taking a page from the NBA's handbook, the NCAA announced today it is going to try to do its 2021 men's basketball tournament in a series of coronavirus bubbles in and around Indianapolis, and here is why. Proceeds from the men's tournament accounts, reports the Wall Street Journal, for 75% of the organization's operating revenue every single year. Revenue that does, yes, get shared with schools. In an ordinary year, it's about $600 million. Last year, when March Madness was canceled, $225 million. No word, by the way, on what is going to happen with the women's tournament. Our daily production team is Andy Corbin, Ali Pham, Maria Hollenhorst, Sean McHenry, and Daisy Palacios. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.